Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the recent retreat from democratic institutions announced by Russian President Vladimir Putin after the school massacres in Beslan has occasioned much criticism of Putin in the U.S. press. We'll be joined by Stephen F. Cohen, a NYU professor of Russian studies, who says U.S. coverage often lacks depth and context and focuses too much on U.S. interests. Also this week, after the debacle in Florida in 2000, you may have had the impression that voting rights would be a big story this time around. But there are plenty of important developments that are being largely ignored by the mainstream media. Danielle Worthy of the Pacific News Service will join us to talk about those stories and where you are reading about them. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
If politicians are not called on their lies, what incentive do they have to stop lying? That's the question raised by the antics of Dick Cheney. Cheney, who once claimed that he had no financial ties whatsoever to Halliburton while he was receiving upwards of $100,000 a year in deferred compensation and held hundreds of thousands of stock options, seems only to grow bolder as his statements go unchecked. Most recently, Cheney told a Cincinnati audience that Iraq had provided safe harbor and sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. As Matthew Iglesias of the American Prospect Online pointed out, that's so patently untrue that it isn't even alleged by the likes of Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard, author of the right-wing favorite book, The Connection. Hayes only claims that George Tenet once told the Senate that there was credible information indicating that Saddam Hussein had discussed giving safe haven to Al-Qaeda. Yet journalists simply wouldn't call Cheney's lie a lie. The September 10th LA Times would only say he was, quote, ignoring the findings of the bipartisan commission that investigated the September 11th attacks, close quote. Sad as that was, given that Cheney was ignoring a lot of other people's findings as well, the New York Times was worse. Their version included Cheney's outrageous claim, followed by the note that Cheney's aides, quote, said that there is not necessarily a contradiction between the vice president's position and the conclusion of the September 11th commission that there was no evidence of a collaborative operational relationship between Mr. Hussein and Al-Qaeda, close quote. Presumably, if Cheney had claimed the moon was made of cheese, his aides could have explained how that actually jibed with planetary science. Simply noting that would not be adequate reporting either.
Newsweek magazine has finally had enough. Their September 20th cover story, Slime Time, expressed their disgust at the state of the presidential campaign. Both political parties are equally guilty, according to the magazine, a frequent refrain elsewhere in the media. But is it really true? Take the first example Newsweek offers, Ben Barnes, the former Texas state official who went on 60 Minutes to talk about pulling strings to get George W. Bush into the National Guard. Newsweek's reaction to his comments was succinct. Quote, and here it is, it's slime time in the most vituperative presidential campaign since the divisive days of Richard Nixon, close quote. Come again? Barnes went public with a story that was true. What's slimy about that? But the magazine seems stuck on the notion that this is about two sides doing essentially the same thing. Kerry got hammered by the Swift Boat Group and, quote, now it seems it's Bush's turn, at least in small measure, close quote. But there's actually a big difference. The Swift Boat ads made unsubstantiated charges that conflicted with official documents, and they edited some of Kerry's statements to change their meaning. So far, Bush's critics are pointing out inconsistencies and gaps in Bush's records. That's an important difference. Perhaps in an effort to maintain this even-handedness, Newsweek refers to some Hollywood fundraising meetings that they say were dubbed the Hate Bush meetings. Not exactly. That allegation circulated by the Drudge Report was based on an email invitation someone had forwarded, changing the subject line to that phrase. If you're going to base a cover story on the idea that both sides are playing dirty, you should at least get your facts straight.
On September 13th, the Washington Post announced that Bush's AIDS plan, authorized last May with great fanfare, had put at least 25,000 people on antiretroviral therapy so far. For perspective, the article quoted two Bush administration officials. Not surprisingly, both had good things to say about the plan. Sounds like the White House is doing a great job of fighting AIDS, doesn't it? But while 25,000 is better than, say, none, what the Post fails to note is that 25,000 is a mere 5% of the goal of 500,000 that Congress had set just last year, to be reached by the end of this month. It's also just over 1% of the way toward the Bush administration's goal of 2 million people treated by 2008. Even though the numbers released only include results from 9 of the 15 countries being funded by the U.S. program, the final count will certainly still fall incredibly short of its targets. But there were no outside voices in the Post article to counter the administration's own sunny assessment of itself. Not that such voices are hard to find. Prominent AIDS organizations like the AIDS Healthcare Foundation and the Global AIDS Alliance were quick to point out the program's extraordinary underperformance. Also conspicuously absent from the Post article was any mention of the Bush administration's undercutting of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. By funneling most of the U.S.'s AIDS-fighting money into its own bilateral programs and proposing a paltry $200 million a year for the Global Fund, these groups and others say that Bush has severely undermined the efforts of an important program not limited by the narrow scope of the U.S. project or the White House preference for abstinence programs, religious partnerships, and expensive patented drugs. Washington Post readers, unfortunately, weren't able to hear that side of the story.
The Secret Service agents that protect U.S. presidents have a tradition of non-political and non-partisan service. But a September 10th Washington Post report by reporter Dana Milbank says that's no longer true. Milbank writes that, though the Secret Service usually, quote, does not concern itself with unarmed, peaceful demonstrators who pose no danger to the commander-in-chief, close quote, during a September 9th Bush event in Colmar, Pennsylvania, Secret Service agents seized seven AIDS activists who'd heckled the president and, quote, shoved and pulled them from the room, some by their hair, one by her bra straps, close quote. What's even more disturbing, though, is what happened next. According to Milbank, one uniformed Secret Service agent complained to a colleague that the press was having a field day with the disruption, so the agents quickly clamped down. Quote, journalists were told that if they sought to approach the demonstrators, they would not be allowed to return to the event site, close quote. One unnamed agent told a journalist blocked from returning to the speech that it was a punishment for talking to the demonstrators, that there was a, quote, different set of rules, unquote, for reporters who did not seek out the activists. Someone, perhaps a federal court, should tell the Secret Service that there really is just one set of rules. It's outlined in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, in the part that forbids government officials from impeding the free operation of the press.
And finally, sometimes mainstream media are so consumed with ideological spin, they run the risk of losing the ability to extricate reality. How else to explain a craven comment like that of correspondent Barry Peterson on the September 13th CBS Evening News? As the camera illustrated recent carnage in Iraq, where U.S. airstrikes had killed numerous civilians, Peterson said, quote, local Iraqis said women and children were also killed. An ambulance carrying the injured was blown to pieces. It was a similar story in Fallujah last week. The military said it killed only insurgents. But an injured baby died, the body brought back to the scene for this searing moment of anti-American propaganda, close quote. If propaganda includes dehumanizing the enemy during wartime, surely CBS's implicit claim that Iraqis think of their dead children as anti-American statements would qualify.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. We'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the program. In the wake of the school massacres by Chechen terrorists in Beslan, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that, in the interest of security, he is proposing an end to Russia's system of direct popular elections of governors and direct elections of parliament. Many voices within the U.S. media have reacted forcefully, condemning Putin's increasingly anti-democratic moves and charging the Bush administration with timidity in dealing with Putin. A September 15th editorial in the Washington Post accused the White House of having a contradictory policy of extolling democracy elsewhere, but going easy on Putin's autocratic tendencies. The Post editorial pointedly quotes George Bush from 2003, describing Putin's Russia as, quote, a country in which democracy and freedom and rule of law thrive, close quote. Stephen F. Cohen, professor of Russian studies and history at New York University, says it's not that simple. Journalism about Russia and U.S.-Russian relations demands more depth and context. Stephen F. Cohen joins us now by phone. Professor Cohen, welcome back to Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Before we get to questions about Russian democracy, the massacres by Chechen terrorists in Beslan were portrayed in the press as bearing great similarities with terrorist attacks by al-Qaeda. Many early reports said that Arabs were among the terrorists, hinting that al-Qaeda may have been involved. What about the reporting about the massacres and these comparisons?
I think the general reporting in the aftermath of this terrible tragedy and the essential tragedy of the death of so many children in the print media in the United States has been mixed. I would say that the factual reporting by American correspondents in Russia has been quite good. They've made a few mistakes in repeating some reports that the Kremlin put out, including the original report that there were 10 Arabs among the terrorists. There were not. The Kremlin later withdrew that. So I think the factual reporting has been good. It's been fulsome. There have been people down there. It's been quite factual. The bad part of the reporting has been, I think, largely editorial, by which I mean the editorials run in the papers, and in addition, general writers of the paper assigned to write more general stories about those events, that is to draw broader lessons. Let me just give you one example that I thought was particularly embarrassing for this country. Some Russians think that we, Americans, and particularly in our media, have shown less compassion for what happened at Beslan than the Russian media showed concerning what happened to us on September 11th. An example of that probably appeared in an editorial in the Washington Post right at the time on September 4th, when it began by a long quote from the Marquis de Custine, who is considered to be the authority on Russian barbarianism, and actually begins by quoting him as saying Russians are the most miserable inhabitants on earth. And that pretty much sets the tone of the editorial, which shows almost no compassion and simply focuses on Russia's abominable behavior. That a lot of Russians who saw that, English-speaking Russians, reacted badly to it, as did I.
Well, now on to that issue of Russian democracy. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, what's wrong with the kind of reporting on the state of Russian democracy and Putin's latest moves that we've seen in some of this criticism that just focuses narrowly on Putin's moves as far as democracy is concerned?
Well, the main problem is it utterly lacks any historical context. It's as though all of this began with Putin. It didn't. The historical context that's lacking is this. The democratization of Russia began when it was Soviet Russia under Gorbachev in 1989 with more or less free elections to parliament. The dismantling of that democracy began in various ways after the end of the Soviet Union, primarily under Yeltsin. For example, what Putin is doing now is basically eliminating parliament from the Russian political system as an autonomous force. But that surely began when Yeltsin used tanks against the popularly elected Russian parliament in 1993, 11 years ago. And yet the New York Times editorial on this question on September 14th, titled Russia's Lurch Backward, compares Putin's anti-democratic agenda to what it calls Yeltsin-era democracy. That's the wrong historical context. Putin is guilty in dismantling democracy. But that process of dismantling began more than a decade ago. So in a sense, Yeltsin, who was rather the pet of the American editorial pages because of his pro-American policies, has been given a pass here. Or it's just a case of editorial historical amnesia. I don't know which.
What do you think about that notion that the White House, there's Jim Hoagland in the Washington Post, several editorials in the Washington Post saying that the White House has a contradictory policy of extolling democracy elsewhere, but going easy on Putin's autocratic tendencies. These are indeed autocratic tendencies.
They are. But my view is this, is that the view, especially by columnists and editorial writers, that it matters in Russia whether or not Bush condemns Putin's anti-democratic moves is completely wrong-headed. We have lectured to the Russian leadership for so many years that they're sick of listening to us. And in any event, if it had any impact, it would be counterproductive. Moreover, to give you another example of kind of strange media coverage, in the Washington Post just a day or two ago, there's a general article by one of its political reporters, Mike Allen, who quotes an American authority on Russia, Stephen Stastanovich, as saying that, quote, many Russians are upset that Putin, that Bush had not spoken out strongly against Putin. Many Russians is certainly the wrong formulation. I would judge that 99.9% of Russians either don't know what Bush has said, don't care what Bush has said, or would resent any criticism by Bush of Putin. So there's a kind of misrepresentation of how meaningful this is. Its real meaning today, of course, is about the current American presidential campaign. Bush's silence led Kerry to suddenly break his silence and leap into the fray with a denunciation of Bush for not denouncing Putin. So this is about our presidential politics, not about Russian reality.
In somewhat a similar vein, there seems to be a media consensus that worries about a recent but growing estrangement between the U.S. and Russia, the resurgence of Russian authoritarianism, Chechnya policy, differences over war, the war on terrorism, and the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky as sort of a symbolic crackdown on big business in Russia, are often cited among these media concerns, these worries. What's your thinking about the media consensus that about this growing estrangement in U.S.-Russian relations?
I think even more than with internal affairs, it lacks context. In fact, it's one hand clapping. The general coverage of the relationship in the American press, take, for example, an overview article inspired by the Beslan events, in the New York Times last week by Stephen Weiss in the Sunday Review of the Week section, attempts to tell us where we're at. All it reports is the American view of the relationship, which is that Putin should have done more for the United States, that Putin's meddling in the internal affairs of Georgia, that Putin's not letting our oil companies have the contracts that they want in the Russian and Caspian era. That area, that's a very strange concept of the relationship, because from the Russian point of view, we have broken all our promises to them. We're surrounding Russia with American and NATO military bases. It is we who are meddling in Russia's backyard, in Georgia and in Central Asia, by putting American troops there and making our own candidate the president of Georgia. So what kind of analysis is this of the relationship? I think the problem with the relationship is that the American policy toward Russia has essentially, as Russians think it has, been based on broken promises, military encirclement, and a general conception that Russia seems not to have any legitimate national interest of its own apart from the United States. That is to say, that anything that Russia does, say in its own backyard, that we don't like, is illegitimate. This is a strange way to conduct what's being called euphemistically a partnership.
Dr. Stephen Cohen, if you could name some essential things that you think U.S. reporting should be doing now that it isn't.
I think the factual reporting is good. The editorial reporting and the general reporting needs to stop reporting the story only as seen through the eyes of Washington and make some attempt to see the story, both inside Russia and in our bilateral relations, as seen from Moscow. Otherwise, again, it's one-hand clapping, and it's exceedingly distorted.
We've been speaking with Stephen F. Cohen, professor of Russian Studies and History at New York University. Cohen is the author of Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia. Professor Stephen Cohen, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Well, if the mess in Florida in 2000 taught us anything, it was that the right to cast a ballot in a presidential election was important. But media interest in voting rights seems to come and go, at least in the mainstream media. Our next guest says there are plenty of stories to tell, and they are being told. But to find them, you often have to turn to the black press. Danielle Worthy is a reporter for the Pacific News Service, and she joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to Counterspin, Danielle Worthy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, in your article, you note that there are many stories about voting rights that are being reported in the black press. Tell us a little bit about some of these stories that you've picked up on.
The first one appeared on July 17th on BET.com, and it kind of explained how the initial list of 47,000 ineligible voters who were ex-offenders contained a little more than 2,000 names that were incorrect. So these were people whose voting rights had been restored, but somehow their names had ended up on this list.
And this is in Florida, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess the numbers in and of themselves don't seem that large, but when you think back to 2000, when Bush won Florida by, you know, a little more than 500 votes, it kind of puts it into perspective. And slowly from this story, we started hearing more and more reports about, you know, how the lists were being compiled, and we had the head of the NAACP in, you know, a story in the Amsterdam News saying, calling on the Attorney General to do something and to perhaps find a better way to make sure that the system is fair. And the West Side Gazette, a small Miami black publication, was kind of the first to pick up on, initially when the reports were coming out, they didn't want to make, Florida officials didn't want to make the list public, and they had to be taken to court in order to do so. And so the West Side Gazette was one of the first papers to really put it out there that the decision had come in favor of the plaintiffs and the list was public, and it kind of started this whole whirlwind effect of officials resigning, and it just started the whole public outcry over the issue.
It sounds like there were some public pressure and some legal pressure, but not a lot of media pressure. The one story you would think that would get mainstream media to sit up and pay attention would be the return of these purge lists in Florida. They were the subject of so much controversy in 2000. But it's gotten relatively light mainstream media attention so far, hasn't it?
It has. And I think it kind of shows the importance and the necessity of the black press, because while this issue should be important to everyone, it's particularly important to the African-American community, because the right to vote is something that is essential. It goes back all the way to the Civil Rights Movement.
Now, I remember when the purge list was first revealed, we got, I think, one rather small story in the New York Times, right?
Yeah. There were a couple of AP stories that appeared throughout papers all across the country, and of course, everyone kind of knew, it was all over the press, so to speak, that people knew what was going on, but the details weren't really out there. And I think the black press kind of took it a step further at looking at the larger implications of these issues, whereas the mainstream press just kind of put it out there, you know, oh, this happened, that's it. And the black press kind of had it front and center.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that some of that media reaction might have been because they would say, oh, well, the list was revealed and it was thrown out and you had all these people resigning and the project more or less scrapped, so therefore it's not a story? Could that be one explanation, I guess?
I think the mainstream press did see it as valuable, but it doesn't necessarily, I don't think it really connects with a large number of people, because it's only affecting a small portion of the population. And for African Americans, gaining the right to vote marked a tremendous turning point in our struggle to establish equality in this country. So to have anything demean or diminish this right was almost like a slap in the face. So it was beyond important for us to really take a look at this issue. And even if it was resolved, the fact that it kept happening, it says a lot. And I think it really spoke to people about how far we still have to work to make things better.
Now, speaking about mainstream media coverage in general, there's a recent comment by John Kerry could have pulled this issue back into the mainstream. On September 12th, NPR's All Things Considered reported that Kerry told the audience at a Congressional Black Caucus event that he had heard of efforts to block some voters from casting their ballots. This is not just Florida, it was around the country, and he vowed that every vote would be counted. NPR's report, though, seemed to set aside the question of whether or not this was actually happening, and they focused instead on the apparent political strategy, who he was trying to appeal to. Is it just that these stories are too hot for the mainstream media, or do you think there is another explanation for why the media don't sink their teeth into these things? And this is, after all, the Democratic presidential candidate speaking up on the issue.
Right. And I feel like there's a lot going on right now with the war and the conventions wrapping up and the economy. And I think somehow those have kind of taken precedence over issues like these, which to me are equally as important, but to the average reader, those are the things that they want to hear about. The, you know, the inequalities and the injustices are kind of backseat issues to, you know, am I going to get a job? Am I going to have money to support my family? And those kinds of things.
And Kerry was alluding, and I know other Democratic Party operatives have alluded to problems inside Florida and beyond Florida and other states. Have you seen much coverage in the black press or elsewhere of voting rights issues that extend beyond Florida?
Yes, actually. BET.com has run a number of stories looking at, you know, disenfranchisement and its effect on the political system as a whole. So this, the, and they were actually reporting on this issue even before the purge list came out. I think the black press has kind of, since 2000, has kind of taken a cue of taking a look at what's really important and how votes are counted and how the system works and how that in turn affects the community's voice and their eligibility in the political process.
Now, with a little bit less than 2 months left until Election Day, if we were to assume that mainstream media don't begin to take a real active interest in this, where, if people want to read about these stories as they develop, where do you think they should be looking?
I would say the NNPA, that's the National Newspaper Publishers Association. It's also known as Black Press America. That's a great place to look. They circulate stories all throughout the black media, and they have a pretty good grasp on what's going on. And they, in fact, were putting out the largest number of stories that were explaining to people what was happening, and also not just the bad things, but the good things that were being done to ensure that this election is fair and everyone's vote is counted.
We've been speaking with Danielle Worthy. She's a writer for Pacific News Service and New California Media. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, Danielle Worthy.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.